Welcome back to Public Address Radio on Radio Live. 2009 is the bicentenary of the birth of Charles Darwin. This continues to be an important event, and it's been celebrated around the world, and in Auckland indeed. So why is it so important?
Well, Charles Darwin was a transition from not being able, not having a scientific understanding of what makes us what we are, to the birth of a true understanding of what makes all organisms, including humans, what they are. Now, he made major intellectual insights into that, and basically, through his work and that of Alfred Wallace, we have the first and still the only unifying way of understanding biology, and medicine is part of biology.
And it's a rather nice, almost coincidence that his book, The Origins of Species, came out exactly 150 years ago. Nice planning to do a book at age 50 if you're going to be born 50 years. So we can celebrate both at the same time. And that book, some people still imagine, is mainly about how species are connected to each other. But as Dr. Kluckman just said, it's much more about why we are the way we are. Why do we have an appendix? Why do we have five fingers? Why does the body work the way it does? The answer is natural selection, and no one quite recognized it until Darwin, with some help from Wallace, made it clear to the world.
In recent years, there's been a lot of political leverage made out of creationism and being taught in schools and evolution and the theory of evolution, these sorts of things. In terms of public acceptance on a global scale, are we shrinking back a bit, would you say, in the last few years? I mean, particularly in America, perhaps?
Well, there's certainly a lot of Americans who don't really understand evolutionary biology, but many of them, once you have a chance to talk with them, recognize very quickly that they see selection in their own lives all the time. Selection is nothing more than things that go on to the future, like what we see on television, what we get on our grocery store shelves, is whatever we will buy. The TV producers put up a wide variety of things, and certain ones we watch, and those become more and more common. Likewise, in the grocery store, the people who put things on the grocery store shelves will sell us anything we'd like to buy, thank you. And guess what? The grocery store shelves reflect that. If you want to understand why what's on television is on television, or why what's on the grocery store shelves is there, the answer is selection, actually.
Look, using that analogy then, I mean, does it say something about the theory of evolution that we now have television shows, you know, television stations full of reality shows and what you'd call lowest common denominator sort of programming, when you'd like to think that evolutionary-wise we'd actually achieve, you know, we'd become smarter and fitter and brighter?
Because there's no direction in evolution. I think that's one of the issues that crops up and the misconceptions about what evolution is about. Evolution is not trying to evolve humans or any other species to a higher level. Evolution is about matching organisms to the environment they live in over time. And so I don't think that's and I think one of the problems that evolutionary biology has had is that people have used the analogy too far and moved it into disciplines other than what is appropriate.
Professor Nessie, now you're considered one of the fathers of Darwinian medicine, and you're out here with the Liggins Institute to do a public lecture. And I mean, I'd like you to explain to me what Darwinian medicine is, for a start.
It's very simple. It's applying every aspect of basic evolutionary biology to every problem in medicine. It doesn't really tell you how to practice medicine. It tells you what kind of questions to ask and what kind of research you need to do. For instance, when you get a runny nose, is it smart to use something to stop your runny nose? The answer to that question depends on whether the runny nose is good for you by clearing viruses out, or whether it's one of the devices the virus used for spreading itself, or whether it's both. Simple studies like that still haven't been done, and here we are 150 years after Darwin, really still just getting started in using all of evolutionary biology to improve human health.
In the example you gave me, just explain perhaps how where the evolution fits in.
You look at problems that people bring to their doctors and ask the very first question of, is this something shaped by natural selection that is in some way useful, or is it just a glitch in the body's mechanisms that's there for no good reason at all? Something like a runny nose or fever or pain, those aren't diseases. Those are the body's responses to problems. Natural selection has shaped those responses so they go off at times when they're useful.
I'm thinking about a number of medicines that you take, you know, anti-diarrhea pills when you're traveling, you know, decongestants, all those sorts of things which are just designed to get rid of the symptoms. So this is the sort of example. What other sort of examples?
So it rather seems, though, that someone made a mistake when shaping us, because we can use those kinds of pills to feel better without killing ourselves. Isn't it amazing? Why is it possible that we can use such medicines safely? The answer turns out to be something called the smoke detector principle. The cost of not having a response when you need it, say an anxiety attack when there's a tiger right near you, that's horrendous. On the other hand, the cost of a false alarm and having too much anxiety when there's no tiger there, that's very small. So just as we all put up with smoke detectors that give us false alarms, natural selection has shaped many of these mechanisms like pain, nausea, vomiting, and anxiety to go off at a lot of times when they don't seem like they're really necessary. In fact, they're not necessary in that individual instance, although in the long run, they're still perfectly normal. That's why we can block them safely.
Another way of thinking about evolutionary medicine is most of medicine is concerned with the how question. How does this virus cause illness, etc.? Evolutionary medicine is more concerned with the why question. Why is it that something happens? Why am I more likely to get obesity than you are more likely to get obesity, as opposed to the question, what happens once you are obese? And if you want to understand the individual, the family, and the community in a total sense, which is what modern medicine should be about, then you must ask the questions why as much as the questions how does the body work. Why does something happen is as important as how it happens. And so I think that's the dimension that Randy, myself, and others are trying to bring to medicine, is to ask the why question.
And what's new about this, really, is not just asking why things happen to an individual, but asking why we all share aspects of the body that make us vulnerable. So why are we all the same in having narrow coronary arteries? Why are we all the same in having an appendix and wisdom teeth? These are all very good questions that need an evolutionary answer.
Your current research, Professor, is looking at involves looking at depression, doesn't it? I mean, tell me about that.
Well, certainly much depression isn't useful at all. It's no more useful than chronic pain. On the other hand, just as pain itself is useful, ordinary low mood when people are facing a situation where they're trying to do something that isn't working very well is pretty useful, because it helps you to back off what you're trying to do and figure out a new way to get to your goal. And if things really won't work, to just wait for a while and maybe even give up your goal. So mood is a normal and useful mechanism for regulating what we do and getting us to do things at work instead of other things.
It's just like obesity. The ability to lay down fat is a critical part of our survival mechanisms because we don't have access to food all the time, and certainly many of our ancestors didn't have access to food all the time. And that's a very important mechanism, a critical mechanism. We couldn't live without it. But if we put ourselves into a situation and we have the appropriate genetic makeup, then eating excess food will be laid down as excess fat and lead to the associated complications of obesity. So that a process which is healthy in one context, namely a world where there is not too much fat, becomes very unhealthy in a modern world which is full of far too much fat.
I suppose the question, as you say, there's a lot of why questions in this. And once you've discovered the answer, and where do you go? Is there an application, or is it just about understanding?
I think it fundamentally changes the way doctors and other health professionals think about their patients, their communities, and the families involved. I think it changes how you will approach preventative medicine. I think it changes the way you treat a patient who comes, for instance, with a panic attack, as Randy explained.
But it doesn't tell you directly what to do with this patient right now today. There's no such thing as Darwinian medicine as how to treat patients theoretically. You've got to do the science. But again, you have to ask the questions. And as Peter says, it really changes your fundamental view of the body. Many people, including doctors, have this view that the body is a machine. Now, that's a great advance over the vitalistic old-fashioned views that the body was somehow mysterious. But the body really isn't a machine. It's a product of natural selection, and it's got all these built-in glitches that are there for good evolutionary reasons, not because they're beneficial. They're kind of leftovers and other problems that are legacies of evolutionary history. And as Peter was just saying, the environment now is so different from the environment in which our bodies evolved. It's no wonder that so many people have chronic diseases like obesity and heart disease and all the rest.
So maybe it is like a machine. It's just a machine running Microsoft Windows, per se, or something like that.
Indeed.
That's great. Thank you, gentlemen, very much for your time. If you'd like more information, you can go to the Liggins Institute website. That's www.liggins.auckland.ac.nz. Coming up after the break, we meet New Zealand's most popular cyber celebrity, and Felicity talks to some of the acts from WOMAD.